Okay, so I'm going to talk about ionometers here. This is a slide that I took from an external review, and I did that because I have enough slides that will supposedly take like 20 minutes or so. So on the assumption that there will be discussion, this will keep us on time. That's an assumption that often fails, but we'll see. And so there's, I'm giving you not so much a high level, but it's more of a highlight picture of work. And I chose it, as you'll see very shortly. So we've done some simulations in different scales, but I'm going to focus on the one force. So first of all, what are the ionomers? So they're just an ion-containing polymer. It's in the melt or glass, so there's no solvent. So there's not really much screen of the charges, which is critical. Here's an example, and the example system really that we're focused on. So there's a spacer length, which I'll mention even now. One of the important aspects experimentally is that one of the people we've worked with, Ken Wagner at University of Florida, has figured out how to make that spacer length precisely. So you can have 21 carbon atoms in your spacer, and that's what you get. You don't necessarily have, you know, you have the standard sort of issues, how long your polymer chain is, and these are not really that long. They don't have to be. But that's precise, and that has a important aspects in terms of comparing with the experiment. In fact, this is what's shown here in an X-ray scattering data. The precise one has this much sharper peak than the gray data here, which is more like a random copolymer version. So in this case, it's a carboxylate group where an ion, you know, preferentially it's lithium, substitutes for the hydrogen. And as I said, these ion interactions are very strong. You're quite familiar with one example of ionomers and applications, and that's the covers of golf balls. I'll mention the next slide. That's not our interest. Yes, Sandia really doesn't care about golf balls. But they are kind of a bulk polymer that's used. In terms of characterizing this ionomer peak, you know, it's named after the polymer name because it's a ubiquitous feature. And it corresponds to the fact that you have all these ions that aren't screened very much, so they cluster. And so this cluster then gives you this peak, and that's about what is known about it. It's very hard to go from this X-ray data to any sort of molecular order, you know, or whatever. So of course all the theories use the universal assumption that it's a spherical cluster. And say something about that, and part of what we'll see is that's not true. This is really our motivation in the kind of the two parts. One is that neonomers and kind of a polymer electrolyte is of interest in electrical storage systems. And part of the issue there is to make something that won't blow up as easily as the present systems. And then there is also...
Can you go one back? Yeah. I was just thinking about this with ionomer peak. So that is 4 inverse nanometers, that's roughly 15 angstroms.
Yeah.
When I see the structure there, how do we get to this 15 angstroms? Your structure there, your cartoon, suggests that they should get much closer.
Oh, well, the ions do. But, so it's going to be a cluster.
But there should be then a sharp peak at that larger Q as well.
Well, there's this amorphous halo peak, which I think will correspond to that. And it will have a bunch of
stuff. Very wide thing.
It is actually not as all, it is really focusing into one area sufficiently to give a correlation function, but it is not a crystalline peak in any ionomer, unless you happen to have a crystalline material.
This is an extremely sharp peak. he shows a red line.
It's 2/2, it's not allowed, it's 2 units in Q. It is organized, but if you take half, half height width, go inverse, you're going to get a relatively small domain for scattering. So it's, that's where the bonus comes from.
So there's actually a lot of interest in that. In fact, the particular system we're looking at is more for scientific purposes, in the sense that it's a much more controlled polymer. It has the weakness of the fact that actually the interaction is too strong, so the connectivity is going to be poor. So there's other systems that would be more appropriate in the general class. In terms of what we're really just trying to do is really looking at this aggregate structure, and what does it really look like? How does it depend on the various parameters such as the spacing and other quantities? And how does it depend upon the polymer architecture? And of course, the issue is that you can't measure this experimentally. Can we do something and see it in simulations? So what we've done, and what I'm going to primarily talk about, is just the coarse grain modeling. It's much further along in terms of the results that we have, and we've gotten some very nice results. We've also done some atomistic simulations, and I'll say a brief thing or two about that. We've also done some density functional theory calculations, mainly looking at some of the coordination. That's probably the least interesting of the three things, so I'm not even really going to talk about. The whole project is a collaboration that involves some NMR at Sandia and some collaboration with Karen Winey primarily and Ken Wagner in Florida. Karen's the one who's been doing the X-ray measurements and just the general characterization. And so one of the things they've done experimentally is they've buried these counter ions. The larger or the heavier counter ions are done primarily to make the experiments easier. They're not the ones that you want to use. But that's kind of the motivation why we'll in the atomistic simulations, we look at these particular ions. So, of course, the basic. Okay. So one of the things that we've done in the coarse grain model is look at two different aspects of the architecture, which turned out to be very important. So the standard kind of simple picture here is we've got the bead spring model of the polymer, and in this case it's every 3 beads is a charged bead in the backbone, and there's counter ions in the system, and that's basically it's overall neutral. However, and kind of looking at this, one of the questions was, well, maybe the charge is going to be pendant. So we've got what we call the pendants, and then the ions in the backbone. And then we've done this as a function of the number of beads between the charged groups, and that's, in other words, this is kind of the monomer length, and it's roughly making it 1 bead, 3 carbon atoms. And so we can kind of do the range that's in the experiment class as well. So the other factor in doing these coarse grain simulations is and otherwise it's basically standard simulation, is the dielectric constant. So it's a uniform, which is an approximation in and of itself. And you know, if it were a polyethylene oxide system, that would be around 10. The polyethylene itself is 2 point something. So what we did is we varied the dielectric constant. Most of the results that I'm going to show you are for a dielectric constant of 4. Down to 2, it becomes a glass. And so 4 and 10 is going to be too high for a particular system that we're comparing to. So 4 is really kind of the simulations are move sufficiently fast, and we're not in the lower limit. It means we're not in the classic regime, which is not the regime where this is actually headed. But that's kind of one of the areas where the atomistic and even quantum calculations would have something else to say. So here's kind of one of the major results. So on the left here I have, we've done a percolation, this is an equilibrated structure, we've done a cluster analysis of the ions only that you're seeing in these images. And this is the ionines and the pendants for this 9B.
How long lived all these clusters? You said you made a cluster analysis, how long do they live?
That varies on a bunch of parameters. So, and for example, here, all these gray ones, that's a percolated cluster. So that cluster just lives. Mm-hmm. When you go to the pendant architecture now, you don't have percolated clusters. You have much more compact. And I'm going to show you the other interesting aspect is the dynamics of what's going on. And there is dynamics we can very easily see. And then there's really an exchange of ions in the clusters by collision, not by so much of hopping.
Mark, you said there's no solvent in there. Why do these structures still look so open?
What you're not seeing is the neutral beads.
Huh.
So this image just focuses on the ions and the ion clusters. And that's how the cluster analysis itself was done. That, of course, the neutral beads are relevant, but the whole kind of issue is how can these clusters form and what's the backbone, the neutral part of the backbone done. And we've looked at that to a certain extent. And it's even discussed a little bit in some of the papers that we published.
So in what sense are they really different? Are they different in a way that for the pendants, you just have to have a higher charge concentration in order to reach the percolation structure like on the left-hand side? Or is there more of a difference than just a shift in the percolation threshold?
Well, that's true when you go down to this NDV equals 3, it'll be clustered. You're at a pretty high ion concentration.
Mark, if you look at the picture on the left, and yeah, there's one stringy percolating cluster, which is, it's the left one, right?
This one.
Yeah, right, but it doesn't take a lot, there's not a lot of ions in that percolating cluster, right? Like, all that black stuff is, all that.
Well, actually, I think it's the majority of it.
What am I seeing? The blue atoms are the largest cluster that percolates, or everything else is
percolating? No, it's the gray is the one that.
Oh, it's the gray that percolates.
Yeah.
Okay.
So these are the larger clusters.
How do you define a cluster in this case?
So it's just a spacing criterion. I forget the exact distance, but some of it just taken from GBAR. And then when we get to the atomistic, there's some interesting, it becomes more detailed to do that. I'll talk about that. So that's one thing. And then understanding what's going on, it's really not that hard, but here's the radial distribution functions for the charged ions. And for a particular case, and I didn't write that much case, probably whatever this is. So the black big peaks are the charge bead counter ion, so there's the opposite charge, and of course they have the closest peak around one, and it's a very high peak. What's interesting and to see the distinction is between, it's actually the like charge peaks here in the red and the blue, which are either the charge bead or the counter ion.
Mark, also that size ratio between the counter ions and the polymer, is that the right size ratio there?
We use a half sigma for most of the counter ion. Partly the thought there was that these are not hydrated counter ions. We also did simulations with one sigma. It kind of shifts results qualitatively, it's not a big factor.
But that is the reason why that first peak between the counter ion, that is much a bit shorter.
So that does, of course, affect locations. So what you see here is that, you know, this is much larger in the like charge. And all it comes down to is when you have the ion in the backbone, you've got space occupied by the backbone, so it limits the amount of volume that the counter ions can get to compared to over here. So you basically can get more ions around the charge beads, and of course undercharged beads can also get around. So you can build a more, you know, dense charge ordered structure with the kind of structure.
That's all physics at the local scale,
right?
For which the coarse grain model might not necessarily be the best.
And well, I would say this: it's probably fine in terms of the basic charge interaction, but you can change some of the chemistry. You can change the charge group. In fact, this is one of the discussion points, Heather, and Mike is going towards these polymerized ionic liquids. So then the charge group becomes a more complicated group. You know, it can be a ring, and the charge is on one side of it. Part of my question there is, how do you even do that in a coarse grain model? You can try certain things, but you'd expect to be off.
Well, maybe my question is, what would be observables that you think are fairly insensitive to the local detail?
Yeah.
Cluster distribution functions, or I don't know.
So of course, what we're really, show that, you know, in terms of the trends and the structure factor, which is what we can compare it to experimentally, you know, we're getting the right trends. And in terms of the nature of the structure, I mean, they tend to be stringing, I think that's right. Now, the number of ions in the clusters, you know, I can see them, you know, sort of shifting. That's kind of a secondary detail, which is, I don't think it's so important. The other sort of fact that goes into this is, if you start thinking, if I do an atomistic simulation, the electrostatic interactions, there can be polarization. In fact, an atomistic force field may not be good enough. There can be polarization effects, other things that will shift what's going on. I'd still say it's an open question of what we should just ask is, how do you really see the difference, and where is it going to matter? Given what we've seen so far and what we can compare to experimentally, I think the first order, some of just the basic cluster analysis, is worked out really good. I think the other factor is what you really need to do is look at different systems. And that's where you're going to run into fairly observable differences. Missing factor is, how do you do that experimentally? And maybe, hopefully, now that they're starting to get some simulation data, there'll be other ways to look at it. Yeah. So this is showing the structure factor. It's pretty easy to make the system big enough in these coarse grain systems to see the structure factor. This is the pendant, and this is the ionese. And the dash is the cluster center mass, indicating that that's the source of the peak. Within the coarse grain mapping and occurring at the right length scale. This is what I just mentioned. So on the left here we have the experimental data, and on the right is the simulation data. And it's arbitrary units here, and they pick a point here and make them all equal. And we're not going to get peak heights at all in the coarse grain. And all we're really going to be able to get is the trend in the peak location with respect to the spacer lengthening.
And so what are you scattering off on the right?
We're scattering, I think, off of everything. I don't think it's...
But what density do you have then? You scatter with the same amplitude of everything. I don't see where this peak is coming from.
You can't, that has
not to. Not possible.
Right.
You're probably right. No. It says here, actually. This is the counter-ion.
Okay, so it says scatter up only the counter-ions?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and the atomistic ones we put in the form. So this is just the counter-ion. So in the coarse grain, you just break it down into each of the components, which makes more sense, particularly for the even the heavier ions. That's what they're predominantly scattering off in the experiment. It's just the components. The green curve here is going away from the precise back towards the, if you will, kind of standard pseudorandom spacing structure. Which you can think of as a block copolymer with a random sequence, which is what we've done with the same average there, and we get that shape to go up.
Another question about the simulation: the three curves there,
yeah,
and you've got two pictures. So what am I?
Oh, so this is just the short one is, I mean, the 3B spacer length, and this is the 5B spacer length.
And what's the greenish curve? And the third curve.
So this is the random block.
Oh, random block. Okay.
Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah. So that's going away from the back to kind of what was originally done in the experiment. Okay. So, in fact, one of the big concerns when we started this was whether there's going to be any dynamics visible. Because of the electrostatic interaction being much more than KT, and of course I wouldn't say be up here for the lesson, but here's just a simple way of seeing it. So this is, and I can't remember, I didn't put what system it is. So this is one of the pendant systems that has a cluster now. So here things are just colored, different clusters in different colors. So that's early in the simulation, and then later, you can see that there's a lot of mixing between this, where the particles were originally one cluster and where they are now.
This is again only the charged beads, or?
So yes, so this is just the clusters of the charged beads, and that's why it's so deadly. So this must be a fairly long spacer length, too, because that would give you so much.
Mark, is it the ion in the counter ion, or there is a counter ion that is roaming somewhere?
Yeah, the counter ion, well, this would be both. Types of beads.
Yeah. Oh, so this picture doesn't yet tell me whether it's the counter ions which exchange or actually the.
It just tells you the things do. And they both move around now.
It might be a big difference of whether the ions might move much more easily. The polymer might always stay stuck in exactly the same way.
Well, I'll show you now. It's not. And there are constraints, I think, in terms of the fact that the overall system is neutral, and it's hard for things. That is related also, though, to the difference between measuring diffusion and conductivity. You need to be able to have the positive and negative charges to be able to separate. But the center of masses can't. Because, the center of masses can conserve, they can do this, separate out like this, but they're not really.
Are all your cluster, I guess the clusters are on average neutral, but do they have typically a small charge, or?
I don't know, and I don't think we even really looked at that. The only thing I can say with some confidence is that, if there is a charge, it is small. There's not a. It's basically charged with a I would expect, you know, some statistics of it, but yeah. So this is just a set of images showing what I mentioned earlier, that the one of the key aspects in terms of the dynamics of these ions is collision of clusters and exchange of ions within the clusters. So this is just two clusters and that were close but not in contact. They make contact, they kind of merge, and they spend a lot of time now as a joint cluster, and I don't know how well you can see, but now there's a bunch of these blue next to the green. Our postdoc's husband is colorblind, so as a consequence, she picks colors that people who are not colorblind have a hard time to distinguish. But if it were red and green, you know, we'd be able to see it, but if you're colorblind, you can't tell the difference.
Mark, for a poor experimentalist, what is the time elapsed?
These are 1,000 steps between pictures. So this is actually fairly fast.
1,000 delta T and then the FMD simulation, which is nothing.
That's what it says.
It's a step femtoseconds, 10 to the minus 27.
Seven, yeah. So, this is fairly fast, but then how do you map this time onto real time?
Any order of magnitude for an ignorant?
Normally what we do, and I'll get to here, is, you know, we would have some sort of mean square displacement and diffusion time, and you'd map that to whatever the experimental measurements are. We have not done that because I don't actually know for these systems what that would be.
On this plot, this is 200 tau or 20,000 tau, what we just saw before?
If I believe the label, tau is probably about 100, right?
100 is 10 tau. Yeah.
20 tau or so, yeah.
So that's each one of these. So we're in the process of writing up the dynamics. So this is just the standard looking at the mean square displacement as a function of the time. This is the ionines on the left and dependence on the right. The red curve is the counter ions. And we can get into the purely diffusion regime. This is 10 to the 7 or 6. This is 6. We've done simulations out of 10 to the 8 time steps. These are not horribly expensive simulations. The other curves are different, either monomers, whether it's an uncharged or the charge bead on the chain, and then the polymer center mass is spoken. Not necessarily, it's clear on this, but in the longer runs, basically in all cases, we can get the center mass to move a few RG at least. The longer the spacing, the shorter the distance it's actually moved. The short ones can move without getting that basic criterion without a problem. There are some details in here in terms of the different ones, but the different parts of the chain, but it's kind of as you expect. There's nothing particularly special. The dashed line is just to make it clear that for the same case, the pendants are slower than the ionines. This is a percolate system, and that's not. So things can move along percolation. So somehow that also couples the polymer motion as well as the counter ion motion. It's pretty easy to understand how the counter ion motion can just smoothly go along the percolate structure. It's not as easy to do this extra step in there with the chains.
simple. As you show, the anions and the countions, at least for short times, get perfectly essentially follow the mean. So you would think that essentially every anion has a countion stuck to it, and it hardly ever moves away.
Well, we know that's not true, because we've looked at it. So there's a period of time. Well, wait a minute. It depends on how you set it. Does every anion have some counterion almost always nearby it, or is there pairs that stay together?
The question is, if you just take all your counterions, and for every anion you just stitch your counterion rigidly so it can't ever move away, would you still see just the same structures?
Well, we haven't done that. I can't say the counterions move and separate from the individual anions on the chain. And that happens fairly quickly. Now, so if you had more of a sticker model, how would that happen? I don't really know. I'd have to speculate. That's not what we've done. That is, though, the theoretical model that's been done more, when Michael Rubenstein comes. That's sort of the way they do the analytic calculations and treat kind of block profile in a sense. I expect it's going to be a bit different. It'll slow things down. One could, they'll ask the question whether equilibrium structures would be very different. And that's not clear to me. Because a lot of that's going to, as long as we're just tied and flexible.
Well, the thing is, as far as learning something from these models is concerned, you really want to know about, let's say, charge conductivity. But experimentalists look at the structure factor. Now, if you can show that if you tie the counterion rigidly to the anion, so it can never move away, and under these conditions you still see essentially the same structure factor, well, your message to the experimentalists is, these structure factors don't tell you much about
Dunham. Yeah. Well, we would say that already, that you can only get so much information out of that structure factor, but I don't think that. So would you do that?
Structure factor on its own is really, really limited. Yeah. Unless you really take structure factor from with different contrast to figure out what you're locating. What you can do is play a little bit of tricks. The same way in simulations, you can color one bead in one color and one bead in the other.
But all of these would be equilibrium. If he shows that the equilibrium structure is essentially unaffected once the ions can no longer...
If he can convince me that the structure he measures is equilibrium in ionic materials, or any experimentalist can convince me that it's really an equilibrium structure, I'd be really happy. Because I haven't seen one ionic material in any of the literature that didn't really keep on changing a little bit after some, with any, it didn't keep on changing. So I won't really go there. There's a lot of things that you can actually connect. You can label differently different species by either experiment or simulation, and if experiment would have been perfect, I definitely wouldn't have been here. But other than that, it's really complementary in a fantastic way. Mach really shows us, we get those peaks, but there's no way we can figure out where the atoms are. And that's what's inside.
The ones that just know, it's fairly easy to implement, right? You can put a spring in tie each one to see.
Yeah.
The structure looks any different.
Yeah.
So in relation to that, what is the effect of the super studies here? So is this phase separation driven by the attraction between this?
Actually, this is very short polymers.
So you replace it indeed by hydrophobic, hydrophilic.
That has
the same charge.
No, not necessarily. Because you are getting a very charge ordered structure, and that's because the interaction strength is so strong. So these clusters, We haven't done the actual order parameter calculation, but there's a high degree of order, although there's one thing I don't understand. The clusters tend to go out a certain distance, but their width is not very big, and then they grow in this direction. I don't know whether that's like a crystal sort of thing, where this is the closed packed plane and this is the direction it wants to grow.
That is the electrostatic effect.
Yeah. But we are getting more string extended structures. And that's actually fairly independent. Even the pendants do that, stop over a certain distance. Variation on that theme, and then it becomes perfectly. And that you have to have at least that sort of strength relative to KT, which the electrostatics give you. If you went to hydrogen bonding, you wouldn't have enough.
I'm not so sure, actually. I mean, it's well known that if you have a molecule which has a short range attraction and a long range repulsion, you can get all kinds of morphologies.
Right.
I mean, you can have stringy-like morphologies, sheet-like morphologies, spherical stuff. So, it's not clear to me that this is really an interesting thing.
Well, I guess my perspective here is, and we don't have any images, but what? What what's not done here is that you've got plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus. So that sort of structure, I think, is specific to the charges. When you go and you have a hydrogen bonding, you may have something, can you get something with a kind of this shape? My expectation is it's going to stop.
This comes back to the strong ion thing. If you string the ion to this thing, you are automatically neutral. You have a dipole. You have a strongly polar object in an otherwise apolar background, and you could rewrite the whole thing as a hydrophilic, hydrophobic problem. So that's, again, why it's interesting to see if the same stuff with the ions can't move.
I don't think you even need to do that simulation. You just need to count how many ions are actually paired, and what is the probability of pairing ions, and how many, 2%, 3% or so of the ions are not paired.
Well, I'm claiming more than that. I'm claiming they always stick with the same thing.
Okay, that's even more, but even just to get a first idea, you just count how many pairs you have.
I guess what I'm thinking is that if you actually looked at, doing this in a real system, the dipoles you get out of the hydroxyls, they're not going to be the same as the dipoles that you or, something similar. But these are going to be stronger dipoles.
Yeah, so but you should tune your epsilon anyways to make sure that the local, how electrostatic pans out.
But the experimentalists, yeah. So I'll turn back to realizing the system. So you have a comment?
How long is your polymer, actually? Compared to Karen's material, compared to reaction. Can synthesize material.
Yeah, I think they're. I think it's 35 or so. monomers, what we are. I think that's right.
But experiment.
No.
You have 35.
How many? How? Where are you sitting compared to Karen's materials?
So I think we're shorter, but they don't make them very long, and so
it's from about 7 repeating units to about 100.
Yeah. They may still be. They could be 10.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out. You showed me the displacement,
right.
And I was trying to get a feel who moves faster, and thinking about comparing it to the ring system.
We made sure. So that helps speed things up a bit. I think qualitatively, the kind of the issue is the chain length relative to. The cluster spacing, so how many clusters does the chain participate in?
Right, but in the dynamics, the next slide will show the dynamics.
Slide.
the presumably the iron one is probably independent or fairly weakly only dependent on the chain length of the polymer, but the polymer one can be suppressed a lot.
That's,
and they're kind of close, probably only because they're short polymers.
But in fact, when we go into 11, it's hard to get to the.
But interpreting this figure in terms of experiment, one has to remember that the polymer you have, that polymer curve gets suppressed. Whereas the ion one probably doesn't much, right?
I mean, there's a certain amount of coupling, but you're right. It's secondary.
It's secondary, I mean.
So I'll just say a couple of things about the atomistic simulations, which we'll get back to our just discussion. So we've done these all-atom simulations using the opalescence force field. Here we are explicitly doing the different ions. Plus, in the experiments, it's not a 100 substitution for the ion for the hydrogen on the carboxyl group. In fact, they don't really have a direct control. They just make it, and then they see what it is. There's a lot of the experiments that do that at 43%. So in fact, that's what we do. So then we have a mixture of groups with the, of course, it's dissociated ion, but basically a charged group here and one that's uncharged. It gives the hydroxyls. These simulations are done at 150 degrees C. There's a lot of the experiments we've done at that temperature. We can get out to around 100 nanoseconds. It'd be nice if we get out to a microsecond. See, we focus kind of looking at the structure factor. This is, I think, an experimental one. And we can get systems big enough to actually see the ion repeat.
May I have one stupid language question?
Yes.
This big thing is called the amorphous halo.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's just their terminology. And
so that's at a larger Q vector. That's an even smaller structure.
Yeah, so that's just the nearest neighbor peak.
Typically, that's
in
the 1 mL, that typically is good. Average chain distance, which gives a kind of rough, smooth peak, which is called the amorphous halo, which is a typical measure of a diameter of a chain. So that's about 5 angstroms.
Mark, what are really the dimensions of your ionomer peak versus the amorphous
halo? I don't like it.
If I take the
That's how it's called.
You're presenting some intensity as a function of Q. What are the actual dimensions so we can figure out if they're...
So this is an inverse nanometers?
Right. It's
so, yeah, so this is around 5 in this case.
That's about 5-6 angstroms.
Yeah, that's chain distance.
That's what I said. It's
it really looks to me like a chain distance peak. Normally, in hydrocarbons around this, any hydrocarbons that is linear has something between 4 and 5 angstroms peak.
That's exactly this.
Yeah. It's not the ionomer.
It's not the ionomer peak.
Right.
No, the ionomer peak is on the left-hand side. That's about 50. Yes, but that's about 15 angstroms. That's inverse nanometers, not inverse angstroms. Mm-hmm. 4 inverse nanometers are roughly 15 angstroms. Yeah, just two.
Do the math. Yeah.
Delta R equals 2 pi over Q.
2.6 between friends.
Yes.
Okay, so now that we've done math, so this is the both the simulation and experimental data for the different ion types. So the simulation data, raw data is the points. The blue is kind of a boxcar smoothing. And then the red is the experimental data. Things have been forgotten exactly which point, but you know, it's arbitrary intensity, so they've been matched to a particular K value. The key piece of good news is that this amorphous halo We reproduce pretty well. Since these are atomistic simulations, we can put in the different scattering factors for the different atoms. That's what we've done. That's part of being able to reproduce this. I think in terms of the overall ionomer issues, it's not as interesting, but it is interesting to the experimentalists. You know, why is this different from that? We can now go back and look at that. And it's kind of a check on their experimental method. We see the ionomer peak, and in the heavier ions, we're doing pretty well in reproducing it.
If you go to the double charged count ion, do you also have then double charges on the ionomers, or is it still single charges?
As we go to these lighter ones, we get very noisy data. It's just a condition we'd really like to have better data. And this is just a cluster analysis. The interesting aspect is that the larger cesium system percolates in this case. The zinc is actually brings in a couple of factors in terms of the analysis. And really, if we do just the ions, it looks very small ion clusters, which in one sense makes sense because it's diving on. And I don't have a picture of the revised analysis, but here's a cluster coming from it. And so the zinc is the yellow and the red is the oxygen, and this is a white one. And what's going on here, which is hydrogen, is this cluster is being hydrogen bonded to this one that's over here. And that's kind of also what's going on over through. So because you've got a combination of hydroxyls as well as charged groups, the hydroxyls are putting in the hydrogen bond network that's also playing a role. So this is actually being revised to incorporate that. And in fact, to do this cluster analysis, it's again the RDFs, but it's each charge pair, and those charge pair distances depend upon the charge pair. And there's more than one in each set, so I'll figure that. Just the take-home message here is we're seeing more of the stringy structure. And then I want to just finish with this slide. So, we've done these simulations, and we're getting a lot of interesting information out of it for the particular systems. But there's all kinds of different questions, and some of them are, if you really try to be much more accurate at the atomistic level, there are a lot of issues in terms of, polarization really is probably important. You should add that, and that's going to make things slower yet. Just generically, how do you make things a little faster? At the coarse grain level, there's also a bunch of issues, one of which is, so how would you model these hydroxyls? We can just say, okay, well, there's an additional attractive interaction between the groups that can hydrogen bond with. We can use kind of what people have done. But is that going to be sufficient? Do you need an orientational dependence? Particularly not even just this system, but in general, this is something I run into. Where you might have, a hydrogen bondable group, and it's not just the fact that there's some sort of attraction to another. Does that orientation of dependence matter? Is that something you have to put into the coarse grain? And then, can you do that in an efficient way with the cost specifically? Another aspect is, the systems which I think are going to be the best practical applications are some like these polymerized ionic liquids. And these are ones that actually Ken Wagner's made. And they have this imidazolium group. And so there's this five-membered ring, and one of these nitrogens is charged. So in one sense, for the ionine, it really probably wouldn't matter. We can just make that a charged sphere. But the whole point of what the ionic liquids is they're ionic liquids that are liquid at room temperature. and they're liquid at room temperature because they're sufficiently bulky, they don't pack well. The charges are on one side, but not on the other. And so the ionic ordering is limited. And that means that they stay liquid as opposed to solidifying. So that's a key feature. So that means you have to put it into the coarse grain to get qualitatively the right results. That right now seems to me is a major challenge. I mean, it may be something that says you can't do coarse grain at this level for the problems. I don't know. And then it may say that you may have to have something in between atomistic and kind of our standard Beats grain model that would still reduce the cost relative to the atomistic force fields. Really just the physical characteristics that have to be there and give you the opportunity to go after one of the key aspects, which is the conductivity, and that requires some very long simulations. This issue of orientation and non-spherical geometries, and I think there's a lot of problems in it that really are going to require that, not just here, but generically, in coarse grain modeling. So this is just one example. But I see it as a challenge to actually do both, as I said, computationally efficiently, as well as just how you're going to do it in the coarse grain manner. So with that,
no.
I was only 10 minutes longer than my slides.
Thank you very much.